Today we are talking about interaction, which is the pillar of how we explore data. Next slide. Now, all viewing techniques fail at some point. There's just too much data. If we think about the main components in information visualization, we've talked about representation, which is the way in which we visually encode the data. We've talked about presentation, which is the forms in which we embed that encoding. But we have not yet talked about interaction. It's very challenging to come up with innovative visual representations to handle the scale and scope of the data that we have. But we can do a lot of interesting work with views and visualization, how we interact with the visualization. It's what distinguishes information visualization from static visual representations on paper. Next slide. So when is static not enough? Well, the first, of course, is the issue of scale. We just have too much data, and we have too many dimensions of those data. But there are some other very important issues around visualization that are only enabled by interaction. The first is telling stories with data. Interaction helps us guide the viewer through a tour of the data to get an understanding of what the larger lessons to be learned are. You can think of this as a guided tour. From an exploration point of view, without interaction, we really have no way of supporting flexible paths and combinations of views iteratively throughout the analytic process. And that's because of learning. We actually learn better when we get our hands dirty. When we actively manipulate and engage alternatives, we dive down into the problem, we get a much better understanding, much better memory, and are much better at eliciting those insights when it isn't just presented to us, but when we are actually touching the data. Next slide. So we've talked about some of the ways that we handle too much data. The first is to pack all the data in one complex representation, and we've seen the limitations of that. We can also partition the data into multiple views, and we will be talking about how we do that in the next weeks. But a critical way of dealing with the data is to use interaction rather than trying to take away some of the data. We use interaction to reveal different subsets of the data. On the right is an example of a very dense parallel coordinates display in which I've highlighted only a few subsets of the data to show me how these particular items, in this case the car database, map to a series of queries that I've made on each of the axes. Now, in this presentation, it's very difficult to talk about interaction without showing you interaction. So I encourage you to follow the links to play with the demos and to watch the videos that are associated with this presentation. Next slide. Even a simple interaction can be powerful. Here's a really great example of what is called the dancing histogram. And it just shows a simple stacked histogram. A stacked histogram allows three judgments. I can see the trends on the total height of the columns. I can see the proportion, the part-whole ratio of each category within each column. And I can easily evaluate the differences in value between the trends in the lowest category, that is the one that's aligned along the bottom axis, because that's the easiest one for me to perceptually compare. However, looking at the ones that are above the bottom axis, in this case on the left-hand side, the bananas, the clementines, and the dates, is a little difficult because they aren't aligned on a common axis. Well, the simple dancing histogram allows us to just move those bars along the axis interactively, and then it becomes very easy to iteratively compare them. So the stacked histogram solves this problem by allowing these trends to be analyzed using the same dynamic graph. And it's an example of a general principle of adding interactivity to existing paper visualizations. Next slide. So what are the critical interactive operations for supporting exploration? Aaron Schneiderman combined these into sort of two main categories. One is how we specify the view, and one is how we manipulate the view. So by specifying the view, we assign some visual encodings to the data in the view, we arrange it, we extract data from it, and we maybe derive new values. In other words, we may look at an average, we may look at a sum, we may actually look at differences. When we manipulate the view, we're selecting items to highlight and to query. We're exploring the data for patterns at different levels. We're coordinating and organizing different views. And we're more generally emphasizing the data to see the patterns of interest. We use a variety of interaction techniques to do this. We're going to cover all of these. Filtering, changing the layout, sorting, brushing, determining how we arrange the data, that's in choosing the form of the data, navigating through the data, annotating it, calculating new values, reconfiguring the way that the data are put together, and in particular, asking questions of the data using a technique called dynamic queries. Next slide. Selection is our most basic operation. It's how we identify the items of interest. There's a number of ways we can do selection. Direct selection, like basic pointing, can be done at several scales. We can select a single point. We can select an area. We can select a lasso cursor. That is all direct selection for identifying what we're interested in. One of the critical techniques often used in visualization selection is called a bubble cursor for touching something nearby. This is particularly important when the data items are really slow. So the bubble cursor will take any data within a certain region of the cursor. And the kinds of responses from selection can, or the ways in which we enact the selection, can be a click, it can be a touch, it can be a hold, it can be a hover. There are different degrees of selection. And in particular, hover is a kind of a partial or a gradual selection. Hover allows us to do pop-up tooltips so we can see details about the data and decide whether we're going to go further into the selection. Next slide. An example of gradual selection using a very sophisticated table viewing tool called TableLens, one of the granddaddies of information visualization. So just by hovering the mouse cursor, I can bring up details of the item. If I continue to hover, next slide, I can see more details when I actually make the selection. So the thing to note about this is all I've done is select, but I've done it at two levels. Next slide. Another increasingly important technique for visualization, particularly as we share visualization or we keep track of it for future analysis, is annotation. An annotation is a capture mechanism for documenting processes and insights. An important thing to know about annotation is that it adds new data. On the lower left, we see an example of an annotation from Nick Diakopoulos, who uses annotations in storytelling. So annotations are a way of highlighting the critical features in the data and tying them in to a larger story or report. On the bottom right is one of the oldest collaborative visualization tools called Sense.us. And this allowed people to annotate points throughout the process of creating a visualization to be able to share it with others. And keep in mind, sometimes others might be yourself the next day, so that as people went through, they could annotate where interesting points in the data were and why they were changing to the next visualization. And it would show up as notes and a transcript on the right-hand side. So that was a fairly in-depth annotation. Up on the top is a video that I encourage you to look at, which is annotation graphs, in which you can see, similar to an Acrobat document, that there are comments on the left-hand side and points on the right-hand side within the graph, and you can actually scroll through different changes of the graph and see where people have made annotations. Next slide. Now, here's an example of combining all of these three tools, pointing, tooltips, and annotation. If you play the video, you will note that as I move through different airport hubs in the U.S., I can quickly and easily see the extent to which they are central or not to air travel in the United States. So all I'm doing here is moving through the visualization, and as I hover over a point, it highlights the air traffic routes to the next cities to where it flies directly, and then with a simple annotation at the bottom, shows me what the city is and what the date was that the data came from. Next slide. Something we do, and you would be used to doing from our demo in Tableau, is to actually rearrange our views. We keep the same fundamental representation and we keep the data that are being shown, but we rearrange the elements. In the table lens example that I talked about earlier, as you can see here, I can alter the positioning of the columns. Now, this doesn't do anything to the individual data views within the columns, but it does affect alignment. It allows me to put things beside each other to compare them more clearly. So even just the simple positioning allows me to emphasize certain features of the data emerging from the comparison between two of them that it would be hard to do otherwise if I didn't have that capacity. Next slide. Now, a version of changing the alignment is sorting, but sorting chooses a particular value of a particular attribute to decide whether to show it from the in an ascending from the smallest to the largest or a descending from the largest to the smallest. On the right-hand side is an example of a visualization that I did for scientists here at SFU. And what I've chosen to sort on here is the total number of researchers with respect to a particular topic. So what the color here is the faculty, the elements along the x-axis are the areas of interest, and the length of each faculty bar just shows you how many researchers in that faculty are associated with that topic. And so what we can see here is that there's an enormous amount of researchers interested in green tech, which is the one on the left, and only a very few amount of researchers looking at issues of food on the right. So we're able to quickly see the balance. Again, hard for me to see which of these is the most in the individual bars, and if I wanted to resort this, I would actually align them differently and sort on the faculty value. So you can sort on any attribute that you want. It is one of the most fundamental and important basic interaction techniques that we have. Next slide. Now, here's a nice example, and I won't go over it in detail, about what's called dynamic sorting in Tableau. And dynamic sorting says that what you're trying to do is sort by a derived value. So if I want to be able to sort, for example, on profit for customer, which is in the first column here, rather than trying to sort on these aggregate values of net profit or sales, I actually have to do a little magic in Tableau, and this link shows you how to do it. But it does enable us to sort on derived values with respect to larger values. And you can see here that I haven't sorted by net profit, but I am able to see how the profit for customer, which is in the color, relates to the overall profit. Next slide. We can also use sorting in some cases to show clusters. So here's an example of a hairball network, right, in a graph. And what I want to be able to do is see where all the clusters are. I want to tease out a little bit of structure of this network, but it's very difficult because it's such a hairball. So I can actually use a technique of representing using matrices to show these clusters. Next slide. And we do this by encoding the connections as matrices, where nodes are both rows and columns, and we see in filling in the cells the degree of the connectivity between them. And then when I start to sort them by how they are common, I can start to see that there's some structure that emerges. This is called seriation. In the paper you were supposed to read this week, They go into this example in a little more detail. But just by sorting on some of the network attributes, the structure of the network pops out in a way that it didn't with the normal network diagram. Next slide. We can also compare different configurations of the same data in the same form to highlight different aspects of the data. So here's an example of a tree map, a hierarchical tree map, that's addressing property data from London. Next slide. So both of these show the data in the same form. But in this one, the hierarchy is first large square is the house type. So we have flats, semi-detached, and what they call terraces. Then within the house type, the smaller squares are neighborhood. So you can see Ewing and Brentwood on the left-hand side for flats. And then the smallest squares of all are the time of sale. So it'll go from the left to the right and the bottom, the top to the bottom. So the ones on the upper left were sold faster than the ones on the bottom right. The color shows the price variation from least expensive to most expensive. And the size shows the number of sales. So what this is doing is showing me between neighborhoods and within neighborhoods to see variation. So here's this hierarchy between neighborhoods. So between the squares of neighborhoods, I can see different house variations, right? House distributions. And within the neighborhoods, I can see similar prices. Next slide. This one is a little bit different. Same data, little bit of different data. So the hierarchy, the first big square is the neighborhood, laid out somewhat according to the geography of London, so that the top left is the northwest and the bottom right is the southeast. So the first one I see is the neighborhood. Then within the neighborhood, the squares show me the house type, flat, terrace, semi-detached, and detached. Then within each of these is the sale year and the sale month. And the color is the average price. Now the size of these is fixed because the neighborhoods are fixed. And what I get to see here is a distribution of where the house prices are. And so it's really easy to see that the expensive neighborhoods are the ones near the center, although there's clearly something going on in the southwest over by Southampton and in the southeast around Richmond. So just by reconfiguring the data and the way that I've changed the hierarchy of the property data, I can see different insights. Next slide. And we can also reconfigure by changing our visual variables. So here you see that I've just simply changed my marks using the famous IRIS data set. We saw that example last week. So you can decide to assign color or shape, whichever it is that you want to enhance the data, and you're going to be able to elicit different insights. But of course, the most common way we also do encoding is to change the presentation. Remember this, when we went from that horrible 3D pie chart to the simple bar chart? Now that's an example of going from an encoding to show part whole to going from an encoding to show different relative values. Next slide. The thing that's important to know that if we dynamically change a presentation, that the transitions can be very important. If you go and play with this demo on my Bostock's D3 site, you'll see that what he does is gracefully animate between the two transitions of these bars. Grouped bars help us see one aspect of the data. Stacked bars help us see another. But if you just change rapidly between them, you lose the memory of what the previous one was. The transition helps us see, through animation, helps us see how each of these relate to each other. And it's a powerful way of making sure that changing presentations does not jolt us too much, losing a memory of what the previous one was. Next slide. Of course, you've had some experience with Tableau. Tableau is the most powerful tool currently available on the market to be able to flexibly change and reconfigure our data views, both with the data form and with the data features. Next slide. A very important aspect of visualization techniques is called brushing. Brushing is a highlighting form, and it very simply directs attention to a data subset within the graph, right? So on the right-hand side, what you see are some baseball data, and I'm able to select a subset of the data to bring it forward without losing the context, to be able to see how that subset relates to the larger set, right? Now, we can brush data using a variety of different interactions. We can use a direct interaction, which selects some aspect of the data or some range of the data, and lets us pull it forward. If you play with the parallel coordinates example that's provided in this link, or you watch the video, you will see that you can actually easily brush any one of the value ranges along these axes, and it will pull forward a certain set of the data. You can select one line, that would be a direct interaction on a single data item. You can select an area by simply making a wide or narrow brush on each axis by right selecting the axis. Or you can select a value interaction. And a value interaction is like a query. You select data items that match some threshold. So you might say, show me all of the cars with this amount of weight that have only four cylinders. And that's going to be a value brush. So play the video on the left to see an example of direct selection brushing. At the very end, you'll notice a particular variant of brushing, which we call scrubbing, where we have an area brush and we rapidly move it around the axis to be able to see the transitions between the different brushes. Next slide. Here's an example of an area brush in a tool that is also used for annotation. I can take this area brush and look for items of this particular area, add annotations to what I see from this area, and then scrub it around, move it around, and then add other annotations as well. So by doing this, I'm able not only to bring forward a subset of the data that I'm interested in, but to add notes to why I'm interested in the data and then generate another view. So we can tie annotations to a brush as well. Next slide. Here's an example of a value brush in the XMDV tool done by Matt Ward. So some combination of attribute queries are data items that fit some threshold and the attribute specified can be highlighted. The thing that's interesting about value brushes is that we can combine them. In this case, what you see here are three value brushes. They've been overlaid or composited. We do this typically with color. Now, this is subject to the same challenges that using color generally presents, and you can't have a lot of different brushes. You can, however, use color to show some characteristic of the data subset. Here, we're using categorical color to show that these three brushes represent different categories of value. But we can also use things like saturation and lightness to perhaps show quantities within the brush to see, for example, how confident we are of the data. So you can use color and value brushes to really sort of overlay meanings onto your basic data visualization. Next slide. Now, we use interaction generally for exploration for several different important analytic goals. The first is simply to overcome limitations of display and memory capacity. And those kinds of interactions can be thought of as navigationally related. They help us move around the data. We also may want to get more information about specific items or specific points of the data. So we want to be able to zoom on the data or to get what's called details on demand about the data. And very frequently, what we are doing is moving from a larger aggregation view to a more detailed or specified individual view. And we do that through forms of filtering and reconfiguring the data. So interaction is critical, not just to moving around your data, but more fundamentally to be able to explore for discovery. And in this TED Talk on the right-hand side, which I encourage you to watch, it's quite short, we see by how Gary Flake shows us how interaction fluidity is fundamental to exploration and discovery. So now we're talking about more sophisticated interaction techniques. Next slide. Let's talk about navigation. You're all familiar with the basic elements of navigation. It's where we have a sort of a viewport onto a much larger data view, and we can pan by moving that viewport or camera across the different data. We can scroll, whereby we move the view either horizontally or vertically. And the nice thing about scrolling is that it's bounded. We can bound the speed and we can determine what the limits are. Or we can zoom, which is when actually we enlarge or shrink the view around the central point. And basically, the detail that's already in there gets larger or smaller. It's basically conceptually giving us larger pixels. Next slide. Now, there are a couple of very interesting variants of zooming. One is what was called intelligent zooming by Igarashi and Hinckley. And what intelligent zooming does is give you smart speed up and slow down. So the faster you zoom, the more quickly you go down into the details of the data. So you're showing the semantically relevant information out of proportion. So this is actually an example of what we think of as semantic zooming. And that is that zooming can be conceptual as opposed to simply reducing pixels or enlarging pixels. That there are different levels of detail embedded in different hierarchies of the information. So when we're zooming in or out, instead of just seeing scaled up or scaled down versions of the data that are there, we actually see different representations. And whatever representation that is depends on the meaning to be imparted. So if you look at the visualization on the lower right, we see several different representations from a low zoom level at the top to a high zoom level at the bottom. And you can see that as we zoom in, we not only make the representation larger, we actually change the representation. We enrich it. So in the middle, we see that before where we saw categorical bars, now we see a categorically coded stacked area chart. And when we actually even zoom in deeper, we start to see a timeline and we see more nuanced detail about the data. So depending on what you have to show, you can zoom within and then open up different richnesses in the data. Next slide. We wouldn't be able to go through our data and to be able to pull out elements of interest if we couldn't filter, right? Now, think about brushing. What brushing does is highlights data of interest and sort of pulls it forward from the other visualization. What filtering does is to remove or reduce the visual representation of data that are unnecessary at the moment to what we want to find out. So it's not a gradient where we actually filter or don't filter. It's not a binary operation, excuse me, where I actually filter or don't filter. It's actually a sort of a gradient of responses as to how much we remove the other data. But what it fundamentally does is let us extract the data we're interested in according to some kind of query, right? And so we can select that data by specifying a query. We can select that data by using a brush that sort of pulls it out. But fundamentally what we're doing is concentrating on a particular subset of the data that meets some specification that we've set. Next slide. In the simplest one, what we're really doing is just changing the set of data cases being presented. So we can focus on a particular set of values, or we can narrow or broaden the scope. So in these Tableau visualizations on the right-hand side, I can narrow my scope by reducing the attributes or the levels of cases that I show, or I can focus in on one particular patient and see all of the other data around that patient. So simple filtering just removes all data, not part of the selection. Next slide. Essentially, what simple filtering is a data query. So a data query, if you were to sort of formulate it in the back end to a database, says, select this house from the Seattle Homes data set where the price is less than $1 million and the bedroom's attribute is greater than 2, and then sort it by price. That gives me this table here. Or looking at our serial database that we used in our first Tableau example, here's one where it says, select this serial database shows you the serials where the value is calories on the bar, the type is coded by color, but I haven't shown another attribute, which is the grams of sugar. So this one says, select name from cereals where the sugar grams are less than 4, and it's the type of health. So in the top, all of the other data is filtered right out. In the bottom, I see some aspects of the other data. But in both cases, some of the data is missing that I'm not seeing. So for example, because I have not specified by calories, which is the height of the bar, but rather by another data attribute, which is sugars, I miss the context of what the other data values are. So data queries only give us exact matches, and they take away context. Sometimes we don't know the magnitude of the results because we get too many hits, and we don't get any sort of hints on how to reformulate a new query. And as we keep going through it, as we keep filtering, we might lose the incremental results as we do. And so reformulating means we have to unroll and go back. What is the way that we get around this? Next slide. Well, we use context. So here's a lovely example by Ben Fry about visualizing the distribution of zip codes in the United States. I suggest that you watch the video or that you go to the link and try this out. But you'll see that as I start to type in the first of 5 digits of the zip code, it's going to show me where in the United States it is. And as I keep going, it gets smaller and smaller. So it's highlighting increasingly smaller subsets of the data, but it's doing it on top of the larger, so I see some of the context. Nonetheless, I can't see it spread around. I merely can see where it falls in the particular area till it goes down to a single zip code. But I am seeing a very simple filtering operation. However, it does retain some context. Next slide. So what it gives us is some overview as well. Providing an overview of the data set is extremely valuable, right? Because people see overall patterns. In the Ben Fry visualization of the zip codes, we could see the distribution of zip codes across the states. Also helps the user decide where is it that I want to go next, and so orients the exploration activity, right? So we almost always start visualizations or visual representations of larger amounts of data with some kind of overview that helps us maintain the context, right? But users need to examine details. The whole point of interactive visualization is being able to go in and out of the data and to explore what the details are, right? Because that overview is aggregated, you simply can't show everything at once. So the goal is to allow viewer to examine cases and data items in detail while still maintaining context of those details in the larger whole. And so the question is, how do we support this, allow them to find and focus on details of interest, and how do we let them get at the details without losing the overview? And the arrangement depends on what kinds of tasks and context you need to support. Next slide. Typically, though, we can do this by combining displays in either time or space. Now, we can simply let people navigate around the data by alternating between overview and detail sequentially in the same place. That's by changing the visualization as we saw before. Navigation of zooming in is a classic example of that. But more interesting interaction techniques let us use different portions of the screen to show both overview and details. So this is a form of view transformation. I'm going to talk about a couple of these. One is lenses, and the other is details on demand. You can think of both of these as being location probes. They're trying to find out specific details about the data within the overview without losing context. Next slide. The most famous of these is just the "you are here" visualization from maps, right? Typically, it's a main and a mini map. You can decide whether it's the overview or the detail that gets the most space depending on your application, right? But the point is that navigating in one affects the other in terms of panning, not in terms of scrolling, though. In terms of scrolling, in terms of zooming, you may zoom in on your detail view without affecting your overview view, with the exception of some typically useful, a highlighted area that shows you where the detail that you're looking at is situated in the overview. Now, you can extend this to a few levels to be able to look at different things or different levels of the hierarchy. But of course, this doesn't scale very well. There's an issue about how big you can make your separate views, and there's an issue about where you can put them on your display, because if you go to more than three views, the display gets unutterably cluttered. Next slide. So magic lenses was an approach that was derived to avoid this problem. And a magic lens is just a probe that gives details of a region, revealing additional properties. So here we see a magic lens over a CT scan on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, we see a magic lens over the City of London. And the one on the City of London, what we see as we move our magic lens around the map are details of the substructure of tunnels and electrical and gas conduits. So it's a way, without losing the context of the larger view, to be able to sort of probe within. And you can think of an augmented reality view using your phone as a mobile magic lens on some visualization. So here is an example where people are moving the mobile phone over a map to be able to see highlighted areas in the map. Magic lenses can be composited, so you could have more than one magic lens so that you can put them on top of each other. And when you do that, you are actually saying, here is a data query for one set of values that I'm interested in, one set of details, and now here's a data query for another set of details. There is a link to a more rich description of magic lens on the website. Next slide. So how do we put these together? What's the way of sort of structuring our views for discovery and analysis? Ben Schneiderman has a mantra that we have adopted pretty well in how we build visualizations. Overview first, zoom and filter, and details on demand. And this makes use of the techniques in both space and time that we've been talking about to date, right? Next slide. In this example of the plain truth, which is a beautiful visualization of the causes and impacts of different plane clasts, you can see as you go through the demo that you have a variety of different tools here at the bottom to be able to filter and to sort. So you can choose some subset of these, and the plain truth will animate to the new view to highlight the data of interest. I encourage you to play with this visualization. It is an excellent example of how you start from an overview, zoom into details, and then easily back out to be able to compare different details at each time. Next slide. What the plain truth shows us is an example of perhaps the most powerful of visualization filtering tools, and that's called dynamic queries. The thing about dynamic queries, if you remember our what a data query looks like a while ago, is they were founded on several different principles. One is you should be able to see your results immediately. Two, you should be able to flexibly combine attribute searches to be able to see things that fell within and without of the search. And you needed to be able to fly through the data, right? To promote exploration and make it much more live. So the thing about dynamic queries is that they're iterative, they're incremental, and they're flexible. What's a dynamic query? Here's a set of dynamic queries. Here's the data for the home finder of homes for sale in Washington, D.C. The use case is that you want to be able to find a home that is within a certain distance of schools. You want it to be able to specify how many bedrooms it is, flexibly say, I'm interested in this price range, and then be able to say, these are some of the features of the houses I'd like to look at, what type of house it is, what kinds of amenities does it have. And the thing to notice about this, we're very familiar with this now, but it was new then, is that I could actually flexibly move these sliders around and very quickly pull out the items of interest to me. So for the distances to A and B, for example, I can see where the houses are that are closest. Next slide. Dynamic queries was actually illustrated first with something called the Movie Finder. Now you'll see how old this is because these are all movies. There are some interesting things to note about the Movie Finder. Here are all of the movies between 1920 and 1995. They have an attribute of when they were produced, what type of movie they are, what their title is, what actors are in them, what actresses are in them, what directors in them, how long they are, what their ratings are. So in this data set, there are 1,500 movies or 1,455 movies, and they're put in the scatter plot by when they were produced and what their popularity rating is. Note that many of these query mechanisms are actually sliders, and so I can flexibly start to filter all of these and to see, as I move the slider around, I can see the data change according to my specification without actually taking it all away and then having to recover. So you can move around, see it really flexibly, change a few things, and very quickly get to your items of interest. Next slide. Here, for example, I've decided that I'm interested in looking at movies by Sean Connery, and I only want to look at movies that are between 90 minutes and, say, 120 minutes. And I'm only interested in movies since between 1980 and 1985. And now what I start to see is a very different representation. Now there are labels on the movies, right? These are the only ones that Sean Connery was in. And now I'm able to sort of flexibly select one and see the details. Next slide. So here I've pulled up a movie. In this case, I'm looking for Michelle Pfeiffer and I'm looking for George Miller. Again, looking for movies of this same length between 2 hours and 3 hours. And what I can see here is that now I get the details of the movie. Important thing to note that my scales on some of my sliders change as the data set changes, as the available data that I'm filtering changes. So I'm not just dynamically changing the data view, I'm also changing the data controllers that help me get at the view to make my task easier. Next slide. Well, that may seem old to you, but here is a much more familiar example. This is a Craigslist housing search in San Francisco. And anytime you've done these kinds of searches, you will be doing dynamic queries. You note that you can set a variety of attributes that you're looking for. You can scale the range of the attributes that you're looking for, and you can see how things pop in and out. Now, the important thing about this is that at the heart of the dynamic query is the imperfection notion. Imperfection is the core idea, because instead of having to know exactly what the values are that you need to ask, you can say, I'm interested in something in this range. Show me all the possibilities in this range. And if it is too constraining, you can back out a little bit and see what else comes in. So rather than having to decide exactly what you're looking for, if you know exactly what you're looking for, you can specify those exact values. It helps you to see how much or how little are available in the resulting search set to be able to explore further. This means you can weight the kinds of attributes you're looking for. If what I'm looking for is a two-bedroom house in a particular price range, but there aren't any, maybe I would go to a one-bedroom house and a den, so I might add in something to my search. So there often isn't one simple perfect response to a query, and so this lets us sort of explore a set of trade-offs and choose whatever the best compromises might be. And of course, the side benefit of this is you may learn more about your problem as you explore these sorts of subsets of imperfect specifications. Next slide. So let's revisit the home finder. Here's an example of dynamic queries that meet a particular set of queries that I've got. And in fact, I may be looking for houses that have three bedrooms and are within a certain price range, and I don't see them. So Spence talks about things called sensitivity. Now, here, for example, I was looking for some houses that were between 1 and 19 miles distance to A, and in the and I don't see them here, right? And I wanted them to be between 2 and 4 bedrooms, but in fact, maybe there are some with between 3 and 5 bedrooms over here. So there's some sensitivity about what if I extracted that may just fail one of these attributes. So they may have failed the distance attribute, or they may have failed the bedrooms attribute, and how do I see which ones they are? So modern dynamic queries often support what we call sensitivity. Here's an example of sensitivity. If I do a histogram of the houses that are available, the green houses are the ones that fit my query perfectly. So here are the ones that are within, on the left-hand side, within the particular price. The black encoding of the houses show me all the other houses that are in here that fail one attribute. So these fail one of my attributes, but it shows that maybe there's some houses in here, the black ones, that are interesting, whereas the green ones aren't. Whereas the green ones are perfect, but maybe there's only a few of them, but maybe if I relax my attributes a little bit more, there are some black ones. So for example, these houses between 3 and 4 may in fact be just over my price. Now this is only a histogram, it's not meaningful. How might we bring these data into the dynamic query in a more meaningful way? Next slide. Well, we can do that to a certain extent by putting data in the controls. So here's an example of the original control in the dynamic query movie finder called the alpha slider on the upper left. Now, what you see is just the slider across the alphabetical distribution of the first letter of the title, but the slider is quite big here, which means that there's a larger proportion of data available in this range. And this is very familiar to any of you who's used dynamic queries where the size of the scroll bar changes. But we can also use the slider to show sensitivity. So what's in the slider? The size of the slider is the lower thumb and the larger thumb. So that's the area that I'm interested in. Inside this, we can show the data distribution, right? Allowing you even to select within the data distribution. So that's one way of putting data in the controls. Another way we can put data in the controls is to show the sensitivity I talked about earlier. So here's an example of my lower limit and upper limit in a slider. And what I see here is just a few lines that show me there are a few houses that I could select, but they're just above my upper limit on price. So if I'm looking for a three-bedroom house within a certain distance and it's satisfied my other criteria but doesn't satisfy price, I can actually put that affordance into the slider as a way of being able to see maybe I should relax my price query a little bit. Next slide. Now, we can do dynamic queries not just with specifying the actual data in the controls, but actually using brushes on different visualizations. So here's an example of where I have several different brushes applied to different aspects of the data, and now what I'm doing is filtering all these views because this is a combination of the brushes. So dynamic queries are simply a way of exploring subsets of an attribute in combination with other attributes and being able to quickly and rapidly and reversibly, that's the important thing about dynamic queries, move around the data space and pull out the cases that are interesting, because we get an immediate and continuous display of the cumulative query results, and we can reverse it by backing out very easily without losing the context of the data. Next slide. Here's an example of a dynamic query tool that's used in managing patient admission into hospitals, right? So the interesting thing that the physicians were looking at here, which is to say, what is the bounce back? Where do patients who are transferred from a particular intensive care unit to a floor because they seem to get better, where do they go back to the ICU? Right, so the physicians are interested in looking at these patterns. I won't go into a lot of detail here, but what you can see is there are a lot of different ways in which you can configure the view. You have an overview, and you also have a timeline. So these two dynamic queries can be assigned to the same data, but on different representations to be able to see it. So dynamic queries are fundamental to be able to quickly explore where your cases are from the overview to the detail, and they are an essential part of any interactive visualization tool. Next slide. So interaction isn't simple. Because we have all of these composite tasks and questions, the way in which you put together your interaction techniques and support them are really dependent on the intent of the task. If what you want to support is searching, then you have to provide flexible ways of querying and filtering your data. If what you want to provide is exploration, it's important that you retain context. If what you're looking at is analysis, then in fact you may want to be able to annotate and program transitions between views. If you want to investigate and compare, you have to be able to have different views of the same queries, right? In all of these cases, we can do this with interaction. Here are some examples of these. If you're looking at exploratory visualization, you might be looking at a circuit, you might be a circuit designer investigating how changing different parameters can contribute to performance aspects. So you might be scrubbing through these parameters quickly and looking at the differences as you change using a value brush. If you're seeking, and you're seeking by categories, like looking in the Craigslist filter, in fact, you may be navigating through a space and driving it categorically. Or you may just be opportunistically exploring what's there, in which case you don't even know what your queries are, and so you might be adding in the representation, adding in new data to your visualization as you go. What happens if I bring in this new dimension, right? Don't forget that, particularly with any kind of visualization, where the data may change without you changing it, alerts, weather conditions, stock tickers, you have to support the recognition and the identification of ambient information. That's when information appears and can trigger a response. So in summary, most visualizations are interactive to some degree. Now, good interactive visualizations have the right interaction techniques for the task. If what you want to do is search, you have to support navigation and filtering, for example. Those fundamental interaction tasks that we talked about today are encoding, that we've talked about to date, are encoding, how we arrange, extract, add new data, highlight, query, explore, and organize our views. And the techniques we use are things like filtering and annotation, layout, dynamic queries, brushing, and sensitivity. You will use all of these types of techniques when you are building your project.